Day minus 783, 0800. Jen is in September, the previous year. She orients herself, thinking of last night, of her father, of the way he looked at her in the hospital bed, warm and alive. And now it's before that again, and he's alive again now too, but not because she saved him. She wonders if, somehow, when she goes forward again, she will have still saved him, and he will still be there, in the future, alive. A pile of blue and white striped presents sits in the corner of their bedroom. Oh, it must be Todd's birthday, his 16th. What could be hidden on his birthday that might explain why he commits a crime? She thinks about what Andy said, about how maybe it isn't about stopping it, but about defending it instead. She stares at the pile of presents wrapped last night somewhere in the past, in a yesterday she might never get to. The gifts are PlayStation games and an Apple Watch. Too expensive, but she'd wanted to get the watch for him, couldn't wait to see his face. They will go out for dinner, just to Wagamama's, nowhere special. It's cold, the weather turned early that year, becoming autumn almost overnight. She begins sorting through Todd's presents on her hands and knees on the floor. These two squishy presents are socks. This rectangle is the Apple Watch. She sets the others out on the wooden floor, looking at them, mystified. That little round one looks like lip balm. Surely not. She has no idea. She can't remember. She hopes he will like them, nevertheless. She stacks up the presents and walks down the stairs to knock on Todd's door. Come in, he says in a baffled voice. Right, of course. Jen only started knocking last year. Next year, whatever. Happy birthday, she says, nudging the door handle down with the stack of presents. Wait for me, Kelly says, rushing up the stairs with two coffees and a squash on a tray. At the picture window, beyond him, the sky is a perfect high autumn blue, like nothing untoward has ever happened, will ever happen. When she walks into Todd's bedroom, he's in pale green pajamas, sitting up in bed, hair mussed up just like Kelly's. Jen pauses at the door, gazing at him. 16, a kid, really, nothing more. So perfectly innocent, it hurts her heart to look at him. Despite his birthday, Todd has to go to school, and while he's getting ready, Jen sees that she has a trial today. A rare event in any divorce lawyer's calendar is a full-scale trial. It's Adam Brooks and Adam Brooks, a case that took over her life for the past year. A couple who'd been married for over 40 years, who still laughed at each other's jokes, but the wife couldn't get past Jen's client's infidelity. Andrew regretted it so much it was painful. If he was in Jen's position, it would be the first and only thing he would change about the past. She heads downstairs, the house empty again, thinking that she can't attend a trial. It won't matter. She won't wake up on tomorrow anyway. What are the odds? Just as she's thinking this, her phone rings. Andrew. You on your way? He says to her. Her chest tingles. It isn't that, in line with Andy's theory, she is living without consequences, but rather that she isn't directly witnessing the effects of her actions, not today at least. She starts to say she can't bear to do it to him. It's the day, he says. And it isn't that she might get sacked in the future somewhere if she misses today. It isn't that she knows the outcome, Andrew loses. It is that she knows him to be heartbroken and that he sounds so flat and sad like all her clients, like her. And so Jen, as she has 1,000 times before with 1,000 other clients, tells him she will be there in 10 minutes. Liverpool County Court is municipal-looking, but nevertheless imposing. Jen hardly ever comes here. Like most solicitors, she tries to settle early and settle often, before acrimony and court fees set in. But Andrew and his wife wouldn't. Their primary argument was about a substantial pension fund due to reach maturity next year. Jen remembers being surprised Andrew wouldn't give it up, but most people who have betrayed or have been betrayed are irrational. It's the single most important lesson she's learned in her career. Look, she says to Andrew after she's greeted the barrister, thank God somebody who can remember the case is conducting the hearing, we're going to lose this. She would never usually say something like this, so bold, so pessimistic. But they are. Of course she knows they are. If I were the judge, I would find in favour of your wife, she tells him. Oh, well, great, nice to know now that you're on my side, Andrew says acidly. He's approaching 65, but still young with it, plays squash 3 times a week, tennis on the other nights. He's most certainly lonely, hasn't seen the other woman since it happened, after which he issued a full confession to his wife. Jen sometimes wonders if she were Dorothy, whether she would have forgiven Andrew. Probably, but it's easy for Jen to say, having been so privy to her client's heartbreak, his dysfunction, the way he's left all the photographs of Dorothy up all around his house. She guides Andrew into one of the meeting rooms that flanks the corridor into the court. It's dusty and cold, feels like it hasn't been open for at least a few weeks. The lights hum as she flicks them on. I think you should offer something up, she says to Andrew. He takes some convincing, but finally, after Jen's insistent, dispassionate arguments that he is going to spend more on barrister's fees than he's trying to save, he offers up 75% of the pension fund. Jen takes the offer to the meeting room where his wife is sitting. She thinks it'll be enough. Dorothy is with her lawyers. She's a diminutive-looking woman, good posture and even better makeup, her physique hinting at a kind of wiry strength, the kind of 65-year-old who walks 10 miles on a bank holiday. 75% of the Aviva, Jen says to the solicitor, a man called Jacob, who Jen went to law school with. Back then, he ate the same lunch every single day, chicken nuggets and chips, and got 49% in the family law exam. Jen wouldn't want him representing her, and it strikes her that most professions are probably full of these people. Jacob raises his eyebrows at Dorothy. Evidently, a threshold of acceptability has already been agreed, because Dorothy nods, her hands clasped together. She signs the consent order Jen drafts carefully, feeling pretty pleased with how much easier she has made this day for everybody. When she brings it back into their meeting room at not even 10 in the morning, she sees that next to her signature, Dorothy has written a small note. Andrew looks at it, the paper conducting the trembling of his hands as he holds it. Jen tries not to look like she's reading it too, but she does. It says only, "Thank you, kiss." Jen wonders as she walks back to her office if this will help, somehow, in the future, both her and them, this small, small change that she's made. It probably won't. How could it, when she will wake up next before she's made it? Just as she arrives at her desk, her phone pings with a text from Kelly. "How's the trial? Kiss." She reads it but doesn't reply. A photo comes in next. "Coffee for one," it says. A Starbucks takeaway cup held in his hand, his wrist tattoo on show. But blurred into the background, she recognizes it. It's a tiny corner of the house, the abandoned house he visited at Whitsun. It's the same shingle on the drive in the brickwork. He's there again now. So brazen. He thinks she won't notice. He thinks she's never been there. So here she is, in the office, while receiving this text rather than in court. It must be for a reason. Eventually she wanders down to Rakesh's room without her shoes on, feet in tights, the way she has 100 times before. He looks younger, still smells of cigarette smoke. She recites the address to him. "This house, Sandalwood, went bona vacantia," she says. "Property passing to the Crown. Is there any way we can find who owned it before that?" "Ooh, bona vacantia. Now you're testing me," he says with a flash of a smile. His teeth are whiter. "I think you can look at the epitome of title with bona vacantia. Hang on," Rakesh says, clicking quickly at his mouse. Jen is glad to be here, with him, in his office, in the past. He's always been so much better than her at legal theory. She should have asked him ages ago. Looks like they're trying to check who to pass it to, because the beneficiary is dead, Rakesh says. Hiles. H-I-L-E-S. An explosion occurs in Jen's chest. Hiles. Ryan Hiles. It must be. The policeman. The dead policeman. Already dead. Even now. Even this far back. What does it mean? She thinks wildly of what the connection could be between Todd, a dead policeman, and killing Joseph Jones. Maybe Joseph killed the policeman and Todd avenged it. Maybe that's his defence, seeking justice. It all sounds mad, even to Jen. She's so far back now. But I looked recently and couldn't find it. His death isn't registered on the General Births, Marriages and Deaths Register. Rakesh types fast, his eyes scanning. No, it isn't, but he's definitely dead. The land registry insist on the death certificate. When did he die, she asks, crazy theories running around her mind. Doesn't say. You can buy the death certificate for £3. Shall I do it? What file shall I put it on? Don't bother, Jen says, jaded. It'll take too long. It takes 2 days, that's all. Honestly, don't. As she leaves Rakesh's office, she walks past her father's. He's on the phone, his door ajar. She pokes her head around it, and he raises his hand in a wave. He's wearing a white shirt and a grey waistcoat. Doesn't look like a man who only has 6 months to live. The last time she saw him, he was at the hospital. She can't stop looking at him now, healthy and tanned. She hears him say into the phone, "Sorry, our accounts only start in 2005. We had a flood." God, that's right. The 2005 floods. Jen had been on maternity leave, hadn't even gone in to help him. Her eyes mist over with it. Her fingers linger on the doorframe for just a second too long, and he waves her away impatiently, which is so him that it makes her give in to a watery, bittersweet laugh. Todd is eating edamame beans with garlic and chili salt. He deftly shells them, popping the innards into his mouth, talking through his food. Kelly is reclining in his chair, just listening. "The thing is," Todd says, swallowing one of the beans, "Trump is actually just insane, as opposed to merely Republican." Jen's heart feels both full and light, a pink candy floss wall in her chest. She gazes at her son. She knows the man he becomes, at least up until the murder, can see the seeds of him just here. He learns a lot more about American politics in the 2 years that follow this birthday, totally eclipses her understanding of it. They watch The West Wing together next year. He stops it to explain the electoral process to her. She stops it to explain the love interests to him. She'd totally forgotten that too. The past disappears into the horizon like fog, but here she is, able to live it again, to sift through it. "Obviously he will get voted in again," Todd says, stuffing another bean into his mouth. "It's the whole fake news thing, isn't it? Anything negative about Trump is now fake news. Genius, in a way." He reaches down underneath the table to fiddle with his laces, bright green ones. That is what was in the small circular box. Jen was as surprised as he was. "He's not a genius, he's a pig," Kelly says, dispassionately. "But I agree, he will get a second term." Jen hides a smile. "Bet you £100 he doesn't get in," she says, "and that Biden does." "Biden? Joe Biden?" Todd blinks. "The old guy?" "Yep. Deal?" Jen says. Todd laughs. His hair falls in his face. "Sure, deal," he says. "So," she says to her son, "what are you going to wish for when the cake comes out?" He puts his head in his hands, looking at her over his fingers. She remembers when she used to trim his nails when he was a baby. He was frightened of the nail clippers. She did hers first, to show him it was fine, even though they didn't need doing. "No, no cake or ceremony," he says, blushing. But he's delighted, she can tell that too, as though his emotion is hers also. They, mother and son, are a zip, slowly separating as the years rush by. And so here they are, closer than in 2022. "Only if you tell us your wish," she says. You can't tell anyone a birthday wish, he says automatically. God, his skin. He has no facial hair at all. His emotions still bubble near the surface. That blush, that embarrassed, delighted grin, the superstition about wishes. It is before he has learned to bury it all, to be so male. What? He says curiously, looking at her. Just, you look so old, she says, the sentiment the exact opposite of what she is really thinking. Todd waves a hand, but he looks chuffed. Jen's eyes moisten. Oh, not the waterworks, he says casually. So weird in here, Kelly says, ever the evasive diplomat. Jen looks at his eyes, that navy blue. They are so distinctive. But maybe the person in the photograph, maybe they didn't have them, not quite like this. Maybe Jen is mistaken. Kelly leans back and spreads his hands wide. It feels like a, I don't know, like a school hall. Why are we so close to everybody? Their mains come. Katsu chicken curry for Jen, the only thing she likes on the menu. I wish you could tell me your wish, she says to Todd. If you promise it'll still come true, Todd says, spearing a dumpling with the chopstick. He insisted on using the chopstick she remembers now. In the past iteration of this day, Jen had laughed at him, but she doesn't today, thinking of what he had said to her about science the other night at the dining table, the things that matter to him. I promise, she says. Just for things to go well, Todd says simply. To get the GCSEs, keep working hard, to become something. What's that? She says softly, holding his eye contact under the harsh lamplight. He looks pale. The air smells of the kiss of garlic hitting the pan, and Jen immediately thinks of her father and the garlic bread in the oven. He shrugs, a child bathed in the glow of parental interest, content to be witnessed thinking, dreaming, wishing. Sciency, he says. Something sciency. I'd like to come to the Earth's rescue in the future, you know? I'd like to change the world. I know, Jen says quietly. How could she ever have laughed at this? I think that is laudable, Kelly says. Really cool. I'm not trying to be cool, Todd says. I just meant it in the old sense of the word. Of course, Todd snorts, and Kelly laughs easily. As he looks up, distracted by something behind them, his expression changes completely. Oh, sorry, gotta take this, Kelly says, jumping to his feet. He raises his phone to his ear, and his t-shirt rides up, exposing his slim waist. He walks to the other side of the restaurant where they can't hear. She stares at the phone in his hand, at his face as he talks into it. She's sure it didn't ring, didn't light up. She looks behind her. Nicola Williams is sitting two rows behind them. Jen is sure it is her, even though she looks completely different. Her hair down, a glamorous top on. She's sharing a bowl of noodles with a man and laughing. Something hot flashes up and down Jen's back. That's right. That's right. Kelly left. He left the birthday meal. Something urgent for work, he'd said. Her gaze lands on him again as he approaches the table after a phone call that lasted only 10 seconds. Work, he says. He's hunched over, not quite looking at them, and certainly not looking at Nicola. I'm so sorry, a client is back early, wants to discuss a job. Do you mind if I... No, no, Todd says, always reasonable, always affable, until he kills. He waves a hand, suddenly looking like a man again, in the hinterland between childhood and adulthood. Course not. Go, I'll eat yours. It's his birthday, Jen cries, stalling for time. I don't mind. Remember me when you win the Nobel, Kelly says to Todd, raising a hand in a parting gesture to both of them. Jen jumps to her feet. She's got to do something. Nicola, she says loudly. Nicola doesn't look at her, doesn't do anything at all, keeps feeding the man noodles. Nicola, Jen says again, directing it to her table. Kelly has stopped walking and is turning around slowly on the spot, watching Jen. Nicola turns her mouth down in bafflement and shakes her head. You know my husband, Jen prompts, pointing to Kelly. Nicola and Kelly's eyes meet, but there's nothing, no recognition whatsoever. They are either masterclass liars they haven't met yet, or this woman isn't Nicola. Jen steps closer to her. God, it isn't. She only saw her through the door of the snooker club, and now, looking at this woman, she's sure it isn't her. She is much more groomed, her hair different, her makeup and clothes much tidier. Sorry, thought you were someone I knew, Jen says in embarrassment. Kelly comes back to their table. What's going on? He says in a low voice, his palms flat on the table. There is something just the wrong side of assertive about this. He crosses over into menacingly angry. Sorry, I thought you used to know her, she says, though she has never met any of Kelly's friends. No, he says, waiting for her to say more. When she doesn't, he leaves. Jen must be mistaken. Nicola must not be the reason he was leaving after all. You sad he left? Jen asks Todd. Todd shrugs, but it isn't dismissive. She thinks he is genuinely unbothered. Nah, he says. Good. It's usually you leaving, he adds lightly. Jen's head snaps up in surprise. Perhaps she isn't here to observe Kelly's behaviour at all. She looks closely at Todd. He's staring at the table. She starts to consider what Andy says about the subconscious, about how clues aren't always the most obvious thing. Their conversation about Todd's science project pops into her mind. What was it he said to her? You don't usually pay attention to my stuff. She thinks of the pizza boxes, one empty, one full, the other night, how she left him. How maybe this is all deeper, deeper, deeper than organised crime, than lying husbands, than murders. Maybe Kelly is a red herring. She's here on Todd's birthday when she's been absent so often. What makes somebody commit a crime? Well, maybe it's about her mothering of him. After all, does every action a child performs not begin with their mother? Jen and Todd have been at the table for two further hours, clearly annoying the waiting staff, who keep asking if they want anything. Outside, the sun has set, the sky a deep plum. Todd's eaten two puddings, ordered one after the other. When can you, except on your birthday, he'd said hopefully, and Jen had let him. You're growing, she says, slipping seamlessly back into the role of the mother of a younger child. It's innate, she was always told. It lived within her, only she had never thought it had. It had taken her so long to adjust. The birth had been such a mess, the baby years so fraught, so busy, Jen felt like she was in a vortex, always something to be doing. The clichés were all true, cups of undrunk tea left dotted around the house, friends neglected, career bodged. Jen buried it, the shame of it, of not falling head over heels for her baby, who arrived in her life like a detonated grenade. She lived alongside it, that inadequacy, got used to it. But then, years later, she still felt the shame, but she also felt the love, too. She remembers waiting for Todd to come out of his tiny classroom one day when he was 5 or 6, feeling like she had just downed a glass of champagne, fizzy with the excitement of just seeing him, little him. The love, true love, it should have eclipsed the shame. But there is so much judgment involved in parenthood that it never did. The shame is so easy to access at the school gates, at the doctors, on fucking mum's net. She can't let it go. And nor should she. You don't usually pay attention to my stuff. Let's head, he says now. He jerks the thumb towards the door, motioning to leave. I'm sorry about Dad, she says to him. A frown crosses his face like a cloud in front of the sun. No, I said it's fine, he says, genuinely baffled but not getting up. And I'm sorry if I haven't been, you know, the mum of your dreams. Oh, please, Mother, Todd flicks his hand on the table, a throwaway gesture. Already at 16, he's learned to deflect. Let's just say, she stops, not knowing how to word it. What? Todd says, his expression softening, lowering. I had this dream, Jen says. A dream is the easiest way into this mess. About the future. Okay, Todd says, but it isn't imbued with his usual sarcasm. He looks curious, concerned, maybe. He fiddles with the fork from his chocolate pudding. You want a tea? He shrugs. Sure. They order from an irritated waitress who brings them over quickly, bag still bobbing in the liquid. Todd pokes at his with a wooden stick. The dream, she says carefully, was that you were older and we'd grown apart. Right, Todd says, his hand creeping across the table towards her, the way it used to. Yes, 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 like this, when he was still half-child. You'd committed a crime, she says, and it left me wondering. I would never do that, he says, his body making such a violent move as he laughs chaotically in that teenage way of his. I know, but things can change, so it kind of made me want to ask if you wanted anything to change between us. No, Todd screws his face up again in that way that he does. He first made that face when he ate a strawberry, when he was 8 months old. Jen had known somewhere deep inside her that it came from her. She hadn't known she made it until she saw him do it. That's my face, she thought in wonder. She had seen it in candid photographs sometimes, but she only recognised it truly when he did it. Her reflection. The overhead lights on some sort of sensor begin to go off, leaving their bench spotlit in the middle, alone, like they're in a play. Just the two of them, in the basement of a shopping mall, out for his birthday. His later actions must start here, with her, his mother. No, you're human, he says it so simply. Something deep within Jen's body seems to turn over exactly the same way she used to feel when he was yet to be born. Her baby, tucked up away in her, rolling like a little barrel, warm and safe and happy. I wouldn't have you any other way, Mother, he says. He puts his hand on the table, motioning to leave. The conversation closed. Not, Jen thinks, looking closely at him because he wants to end the discussion, but because he doesn't think that a meaningful discussion has even taken place. They get to the car, and Jen almost tells him then that it wasn't a dream, that it's real, that it's the future, and that she's doing her best to save him, her baby boy, from that grisly fate, that crime, that knife, that blood, that murder charge. But he wouldn't believe her. Nobody would. Just look at him, pink-cheeked in the cold, the hint of a chocolate smear rimmed around his lips, just like when he was tiny and she weaned him on all sorts, but mostly on his and her favourite, Bourbon biscuits. They ate so many of them. She almost hopes she can go back to then, even further. Perhaps it is not directly about Kelly, but about how Todd reacts to whatever his father has done. Mad that I used to be able to carry you. And now look, she says, looking up at him. I bet I could carry you now. I bet you could. His arm is still across her shoulders, hers around his waist. It occurs to her, as they walk to her car, that this might be the last time they embrace. She's pretty sure Todd gives it up after this age, becomes too cool for it. The first time she walked with him on his birthday here tonight, she didn't know. She didn't know it might be the last time. A voice downstairs. Jen was almost asleep, but clearly not quite. She walks soundlessly past the picture window, down, down, down into the house. Kelly is in the study, off the hallway, and Jen pauses, listening. He's on the phone. Yeah, all right, he says. Tell Joe I called as soon as you can get hold of him in the morning, yeah? Joe. But it can't be the prison. It doesn't sound like he's talking to an organisation. And it's so late. It must be a mutual acquaintance of some sort. Yeah, exactly, he says. Wouldn't want him to think I don't care. He says it very carefully, slowly, stumbling over the words like an amateur picking a guitar. Wouldn't want to ruin a 20-year business partnership. Jen sits down on their bottom step. 20 years. Those two words are doubly significant. A betrayal, but also a prophecy of how far back she may have to go. Day minus 1095, 0655. Jen has an iPhone XR, she thinks. It feels like a big rectangular block in her hand. She stares down at it in shock, where it rests against the duvet. She upgraded it. She remembers it so clearly because it stopped connecting with her car's Bluetooth and she couldn't check up on her neediest clients on the way home from work. She checks the date now. The 30th of October, 2019. A Wednesday. 3 years before. Almost exactly 3 years before. She makes a cup of tea downstairs, the house silent and empty. Todd isn't up yet. Kelly isn't here, even though it's so early. Their oak tree out the back is in all its autumn splendour. Three mushrooms poke out of the base of the tree. She opens the door. The ground has that smoked damp smell, winter revving its engine softly. She sips her tea, standing with cold bare feet on the patio, wondering if she will ever see November 2022. The steam curls upwards, obscuring her vision. Jen is angry and now fixated on what it is that she is supposed to uncover about her husband or her son. Kelly has been a natural father. Kelly is a natural everything, never plagued by a surplus of thoughts, by resentment, by guilt. He loved the baby they made, and that was that. Jen had watched his transformation with interest. "That smile makes it all worth it," Kelly had said one morning at 4 o'clock, the moon out, only the owls and the babies of the world awake. But sacrifice is a different notion for men and women. Worth what, exactly? Kelly did not have his body change, his nipples crack right across the centre like smashed dishes. Jen now agrees it is worth it all, but she sometimes wonders if that is because some of the things she lost have been given back to her. Sleep. Time. That is where the damage might live, she thinks, if she has somehow caused something to happen within Todd, which she is sure she must. Never a confident parent, Jen feels certain, deep inside herself, that something must have happened, maybe in Todd's early years. When Todd was 4, she clean forgot to collect him from nursery, thought Kelly had done it. Todd had been waiting with his key worker outside a locked-up nursery. She winces as she thinks of it now, standing here in the mildewing autumn. Is it that sort of thing that would lead him to think, much, much later in life, that he must solve whatever his father is mixed up in? It isn't about Kelly, perhaps, but Todd's response to it. "Hope you're ready," Todd shouts from upstairs, his voice wobbling, still breaking. "It's finally here." Anxiety fires off in Jen's stomach. She has no idea what today is, and she has no idea what to expect her son to be like. He'll be 15, Jesus Christ. He arrives, and a stranger is in Jen's kitchen. A ghost. The past. Her history. Todd's a child. He looks barely older than 10. He developed late. She'd forgotten. All the worrying she did about it, gone, into the ether, as soon as it corrected itself. Everything in parenthood feels so endless until it ceases. He shot up sometime before his 16th, seemed to lengthen in his sleep. Hormones, growing pains, his voice broke, his arms became spindly and elongated before they filled out. But here he is, before it happened, her little Todd. "It is today," she says, her mind idling like a spinning wheel. October, 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 she has no idea. It isn't his birthday. It isn't a significant date in any way, but clearly it is to him. "Get dressed then," he says, then adds happily, "I will too." Jen knows that she can't ask where they're going, can't let on that she has forgotten. He turns to her, as he always used to. Jen encircles his bony shoulders with her arm in the hallway, hope firing down her spine like somebody struck a match. This is it. This must be it. Significant outings with her son are where she is being led. Staying in Wagamama's with Todd on that chilly autumn birthday night was the right thing to do. No child can be loved too much. And so Jen is really getting what she has always most wanted, a do-over in parenting. "What do you think I should wear?" she asks him, hoping for clues. Definitely smart cash, Todd says, like a child actor. She follows him up the stairs. His walk is different, the awkward lope of the child who isn't yet comfortable in his own body. Smart casual. Okay, she echoes. Todd follows her into her bedroom and ambles through to use their ensuite shower. Oh yes, that's right. He went through a phase of preferring that one for no reason at all. Just the rhythm of family life. Like the way Henry VIII finds a favoured spot to sleep in and changes it every few months. Todd didn't care too much when he was 15 about privacy, didn't reach the teenage self-consciousness until late too. She remembers being troubled by the open door to the ensuite, but not knowing quite how to address it. Soon enough, like many things, it had addressed itself, and he had begun to use the main bathroom, door firmly locked into place. Using this towel, Todd calls. Okay, Jen shouts back softly. Sure. She heads out onto the landing, hoping to find Kelly, but there's no evidence of him around. His car isn't on the drive. His trainers are gone. It's so early. Is he at work, or... He was gone before she woke this morning. No opportunity to put the tracker on his phone. Jen's fingers brushed the paintwork of her bedroom. It's still magnolia, the way it was before they painted over it. Grey, then got the new carpets. She lives their renovation in reverse. There's nothing in her phone to mark this date. She searches her emails, but there's nothing there either. She's about to go and check the fridge for tickets stuck up with magnets when Todd speaks. Although, he calls, his voice small over the running shower, the NEC is huge, so maybe trainers? Right. The science fair at the NEC. A good day out. Sweets on the motorway, laughs, hot chocolates on the way home. Jen had been bored by the science, but she hoped she hid it well. Evidently not. Really, that is totally expected, Todd says, watching a smoking test tube dispassionately. Big feet, big hair, a hidden smile. He's pretending not to enjoy himself, but he's buzzing. What did they expect from solid CO2? Well, it looks like magic to me, Jen says. Todd shrugs. They cross over the blue-carpeted hall, browsing the stands. It's crowded in here, the high ceiling doing nothing to offset the claustrophobia, the artificial heat, the dichotomy of the people who want to be there, inevitably paired with people who do not, who are indulging them, who love them. Jen's lower back is aching, just as it did the first time she lived this day. She'd wanted to go to the shop, the cafe, had looked at her phone too much instead of at the science exhibits and her son. She determinedly hasn't looked at anything else today. That one looks good, Todd says now, pointing. A small marquee has been set up along the edge of the exhibition hall. An official-looking man in a high-vis jacket is manning it. Through the throngs of people walking slowly, stopping to fiddle with things, buying cans of Coke at the various stalls, Jen can see its name. The Science of the World Around Us. Todd strides off ahead of her, and she follows. He goes towards a space exhibit, Jen towards a section called Things to Play With. Anything catch your interest? A woman in a blue T-shirt behind a glossy white counter says. Various science gadgets litter the desk in front of her. Something that looks like a crystal ball that calls itself a radiometer. Newton's cradle. A giant clock that has all of the world's time zones on it. Jen is hot, the veins in her hands swollen. There are too many people in here, in this all-white space. She feels like Mike TV. She looks around for Todd. He's still in the headset, his shoulders shaking with laughter. He has a tote bag slung over his shoulder with various pamphlets and freebies in it. Soon he will pick up some free mints. They eat them for months afterwards. No thanks, she says to the woman, moving away from the weird science toys. She turns around in a slow circle, looking at the exhibitions. Surely, surely, surely she could learn something here. And that's when she sees him. At a busy stand called Wrong Place, Wrong Time. Andy. It's Andy. Younger Andy, lither and, very interestingly, more smiley too. He's handing out pieces of paper. It's part of my research into memory, he is telling a woman there with her twin boys. Jen takes one. As his eyes meet hers, there's nothing, not even a flicker. Of course there isn't. Memory, she says. Yes, specifically the storage of it, how in people with good memories that storage is very organized. Do you study subconscious memory, she asks. She had no idea he had started out like this. He never said. She never asked. Or, she gestures to the sign, time. Same thing, aren't they? He says with a small smile. The past is memory, is it not? Suddenly, alone in a crowd, here in the past, Jen feels like she is almost at the end, feels instinctively that this is the last time she will see Andy. The gruesome past is rushing towards her. She takes one of his questionnaires, then leans her elbows on the counter in front of Andy. We've met, she says. Confusion flickers across his features. Sorry, It is in the future that we've met, she says, but then actually she thinks that is unlikely to be true. On the day she figures it all out, whenever that is, Andy seems to think it will play through from there, erasing everything, erasing all this backward stuff. Which really has just been research into the past, hasn't it? So it's truer to say that they have never met. How funny. Their truths are the same here in the NEC, years back. She holds a hand out to placate him. I always ask you the same questions, but I'm hoping sometimes your answers will be different. He blinks at her, then slowly pulls the piece of paper back from her grasp. He's still looking at her. His beard is darker and fuller. He's slimmer. No wedding ring. Jen thinks of all the things she could tell him, the scant few details she knows about his life in the future. Perhaps he wouldn't go on to study time loops. Perhaps she'd change his future entirely, though she couldn't make that change stick. And that's when she plays her trump card. You told me, in the future, to tell you that your imaginary friend was called George. Before she's finished speaking, he has interrupted her with a sharp inhale. George, he says, his voice full of wonder. That's what I tell the time travelers, I know, she whispers, the hairs on her arms standing up. Magic. This is magic. How can I help? Jen tells him again. She's lost count of the number of times she has told this story. Andy listens intently, his face less lined than before, his demeanour less grumpy too. Sometimes, he says gently when she's finished, the emotions of living something the first time prevent us from seeing the true picture, don't they? He rubs at his beard. If I could go back, the things in my life that I would just stand and truly, fully witness if I knew how they were gonna turn out. Jen stares at Andy, this younger, less jaded, more sentimental version of him. Maybe it's that, she says, watchfulness, witnessing her life, and all its minutiae, from a distance in a way. And maybe that's all she needs to know. I have to wonder, though, he says, how you would be able to create enough force to enter a time loop. It would have to be, I know, she says quickly, a superhuman kind of strength. That one remains a mystery. She raises a hand to him, then turns and walks back to her son and the path they are on together. Here, deep in the past, she feels almost ready. Todd takes the headset off and beckons her over, offering her a mint. C10H20O, he says, crunching one. The chemical formula for menthol. How do you know that? She says. God, she loves him. She drapes an arm around his shoulders. He glances at her in surprise. Oh, just let them stay here, in his boyhood, together, without anything else. Just do. I mean, it's only two oxygen molecules different from decanoic acid, he says happily, as though that is an explanation. This is exactly the sort of sentence Jen would have laughed at. Thanks for the clarification, she would have said. She might have said. But she doesn't today. Banter can hide the worst sins. Some people laugh to hide their shame. They laugh instead of saying, I feel embarrassed and small. She suddenly thinks of Kelly, the easy humour they've always had. But when has Kelly ever told her how he felt? If she observes him dispassionately, what might she see? Anyway, even if this knowledge about Todd, this compassion, doesn't stop the crime, Jen is glad she has it anyway. Glad her son spoke his truth to her that night in their kitchen when he said he cared about physics. "What are your thoughts on time travel?" she asks him. "Totally possible," he says. "Yeah? They say time is only linear because of cause and effect. You're going to have to come down a level or two." A way of us thinking, well, he glances at her face. He raises his eyebrows at a donut stand. She nods and they queue there. "Never mind," he says. "No, what? You'll find it boring, I can tell. Your eyes glaze over." "I won't," she says hurriedly. "I'm never bored by you. You explain things so well." He comes to life. "All right, then. Time is just a way of us thinking we are free agents, that our actions have cause and effect. That's what makes us think that time flows in one direction, like a river." "But it doesn't." Todd shrugs, looking at her. "Nobody knows," he says. And Jen instantly feels very sorry for past Jen, and even more so for past Todd, that she felt, that she decided that this relationship with her son, this intellectual relationship, wasn't accessible to her. As it goes, she now knows more about non-linear time than anyone. "Like the hindsight paradox," he continues when he's bought the donuts. "Everyone thinks they knew what was going to happen. They said, 'I knew it all along,' but actually, they would say that no matter what the outcome, because our brains are so good at considering every possibility. We've known whenever anything was going to happen." Jen thinks about that, tries to digest it. Todd would be able to solve his own crime in 5 seconds flat. He's so smart. And here he is, still a kid, his mind unmuddied by convention. He's the perfect person to have this chat with out of everybody in the whole world. What are the chances of that? She decides eventually to say just that. "You're so smart, Toddy," she says. They walk past a medical stand, diabetes tests, ECGs, a stand about the importance of abdominal aortic scanning. "Want your aorta scanned," he jokes, but she knows he heard her, knows he took in the compliment. "Sure enough," he says, "when I discover some new chemical compound, you'll say, 'I knew it all along.'" Jen laughs. "Probably." Todd opens the donuts. "Want a whole one or a bite?" he offers. And for some reason, Jen remembers this exact moment. She had said no, she was on a diet. That's right, and God, she's in fucking size 12 jeans, not what she is in 2022. "A bite, please," she says, standing in a crowded corridor of the NEC with her son, who thrusts a sugared piece towards her. People huff past them, annoyed, but they don't care. She bites it off the end of his finger like an animal, and he laughs, eyebrows up, smile wide, suspended in animation, in her gaze. Ryan delivers the third car in as many weeks to Ezra. It's the dead of the night, between 3 and 4. He's knackered. He's never been able to lie in, so he's hardly getting any sleep. His arms and legs feel heavy and he's cold, his body trembling. "Thanks very much," Ezra says to him. Just as he's about to leave, his colleague, Angela, arrives. "Aha," Ezra says. Angela smiles at Ryan. It's a careful smile, one that says, familiar but not in cahoots. She's wearing tracksuit bottoms, no makeup, hair scraped back into a ponytail, ashy roots showing. "I have a Merc for you," she says to Ezra. "Bit tricky as the key was just out of reach, so I had to go in, broke the little window above the toilet with a hammer." Ezra rubs a hand over his beard. Right. "But the owners were out, though." He checks this like a friendly office manager, not a criminal, then dutifully ticks the car off his clipboard. "Plated?" "Yep," Angela says. "No alarm." It's a chilly night. March, but still frosty, the air ice rink cold. Ryan's eyes feel gritty. It's slowly dawning on him that being undercover is, like most jobs, sometimes tedious, sometimes irritating, and very tiring. Yeah, amazing how many people don't turn it on when they go on holiday, Ezra says. But his tone goes down at the end, is dark, ironic somehow, like he's making a private joke with himself. Angela is not an idiot, so changes tack, though Ryan wants to press him to just ask the question. So, how do you know they're away? Anyway, should be a good one, she says. It's pretty new. The Middle East like a merc, Ezra says. He's a man of few words. Ryan recognises just his type. Kelly was similar. Cards close to his chest. His explanations credible enough so as not to invite any questions, but absolutely nothing more than necessary given away. You didn't even know he had evaded you most of the time. Came away with no answers, usually laughing, then thought, hang on. You can learn a lot from him. You got your texts for tomorrow, Ezra says. This is another thing about undercover. The lines between work and play become so blurred. Ryan isn't supposed to be on shift tomorrow, but really, what can he say? Sorry, not down to work? Yep. You're good kids, you two, Ezra says. And Ryan thinks how funny it is that underneath it all, this statement is completely true, only not quite in the way Ezra thinks. I love it, Ryan says. Easiest money I ever made. Imagine having a fucking normal job where you give half to the tax man. Ezra makes a noise that sits somewhere between a grunt and a laugh. Yeah, clock in, clock out, national insurance, no second homes in Marbella, he says. Marbella? More intel. They can try to trace the money that he bought that asset with. Exactly. These rich twats don't need their second cars anyway, Ezra adds. Ryan scuffs the ground with his foot. He has learned during his time in the police of the power of silence, and he exerts that now for the first time. He can tell Ezra is about to say something significant. But it was such a fucking circus with the baby. Ryan keeps his face completely expressionless, though his body has begun to sing with anticipation. Too right, Angela says delicately. Bad eggs, were they? Ha! Eggs, Ezra says. You talk weird sometimes, you do. Ryan winces, barely detectable to Ezra, Ryan hopes. Two fucking pagans, Ezra says. Pagans. Gang speak for disloyal foot soldiers. It's all information that might lead Ryan upwards, towards the big guy, and more importantly, to Ryan anyway, to the baby. If he could get the baby and let the gang go, he would. He can't sleep for thinking about her. Alone, scared, in God knows whose custody, missing her mother. He cannot think about it. They start walking towards the car so that Ezra can check them in. The forecourt is littered with broken glass and cigarette butts. Ryan thinks idly again of the risk he's taking, of the notion that he has consented to this danger. He wonders suddenly from nowhere what the fatality rate for undercover police officers is, how often they get rumbled, how often they overstep the line in the quest for information. How did they not even see a baby, though, he says. Angela scratches her nose, an agreed cue to rein it in, but Ryan ignores her. Fucking jokers, right? Ezra says, becoming more animated. Think they just didn't care, he holds his hands up. And I didn't care about no fucking baby, but I do care about the fucking jacks from the major crime unit being onto us. Angela's nose must be really itchy, but Ryan continues asking questions. He can't stop. The baby just head on to the ship in the end, then. They're at the cars now, and Ezra leans a hand against the bonnet. He turns his head to look properly at Ryan, a slow, animalistic rotation. Eventually their eyes meet, and Ryan sees flint and thinks he's fucked it. But he hasn't. Are you joking? Ezra says. Of course I didn't let them put that baby on the ship. Ryan pauses, holding his breath. They're teetering now on the edge of something. Just as he's about to ask, Angela reaches her hand out. You'd never know what it meant unless you knew. Yeah, I mean, good call, Ryan says. His instincts agree with Angela this time. But look where they got him first. He can tell his handler, who can tell the CID, that the baby is in this country, not shipped out to the Middle East, thank God. Evidently stopping was the right decision, because Ezra says, "I'm heading to see the boss tomorrow night." "The mastermind," Ryan says. He is even starting to sound different, phasing out the Welsh accent he inherited from his father. How easy it would be to lose yourself forever in this life, to live, literally, the life of another identity, so much that you might become it. Ezra points at Ryan. It's so cold that his jaw is trembling, the air that chalk dust dry of snow. "You should come." He looks at Angela, then uses her undercover alias. "You too, Nicola." Day minus 1672, 2125. Todd is 13. He's 4.5 feet of 13-year-old boy. He smells of biscuits and the great outdoors. He's currently in the back of their old car that they trade in for a better model in a few years' time, kicking Jen's chair in the way he did that she hated and is now nostalgic for, sort of. It is the 1st of April. As soon as Jen woke up this morning, the sun, a yellow melted pool on their hallway floor, she remembered this day, this weekend. It is Easter Sunday. They are on their way back now from a village fair, followed by dinner. Simple things, family things. Jen has forgotten herself for some of the day, laughing at her son's banter, her husband's quick remarks. It was a perfect weekend the first time around. The weather had made it. They'd spent almost all of it outside with friends, barbecuing, a small party with their inner circle. And so on the Sunday, in this exact car ride, Jen remembers so vividly Kelly looking at her and saying, "And we've still got a hall bank holiday tomorrow, too." She wonders curiously why she remembers that exact phrase so well. Some days she supposes are brighter than others, more memorable. Some days even the great ones, like their wedding, fade away into history. And now here they are again. Jen remembers spending a portion of this car journey worrying she had upset her father at the office on the Thursday night about a directions hearing on a case. She wishes she could stretch an arm back into the past and shake that Jen. Life is so short, it rushes by. "He'll be dead one day," she would tell her, but she can't. Jen is that Jen, today. The car is dark and quiet, the radio on low, the heater on high, just the way she likes it. Her skin feels stretched. She had forgotten that they both got burnt today, the first time, and they made exactly the same mistake today. That deceptive British springtime sun, the air refrigerated, the sun molten. The sun set about 5 minutes ago. The sky beyond the motorway is rose water pink. They've been discussing Brexit. "They just need to get on with it now," Todd adds, a view he will later retract. "They should have been more considered," he will say, when the queues stack up at the ports. It's been the nicest day in the sun, and Jen can't work out why she's here. On every other day, she's been able to find at least something, a small, confusing clue, something to change, a piece of the mystery, but this day has played out exactly as it did then. Fuck it. She leans her temple against the passenger window and closes her eyes. Kelly is driving. In the present day, he drives much less. She had forgotten that he almost always used to drive. His left hand rests casually on her knee. She will just enjoy the rest of the day. Maybe if she stops trying to learn from it, something will happen. "Can I stay up when we get in?" Todd asks from the back. Jen opens her eyes and checks her watch. It's just gone 7:30. She has no idea what time Todd went to bed when he was 13. It became a blur, that creep towards adulthood. She looks across at Kelly, raising her eyebrows. He shrugs. "Yeah, why not?" he says. "Can we play Tomb Raider?" "For sure." Todd laughs, a happy sigh. Kelly looks at Jen. "You just like Lara Croft," she says in a low voice to him. "Oh yeah, you know how I love computerized tits." "What?" Todd calls from the back. Kelly flashes her a grin. "I said, we've still got a whole bank holiday tomorrow, too." Jen smiles back at him in the darkness of the car, just as he takes the slip road. too right, she says softly, hoping he can't hear the nostalgia and grief in her voice. And something else, too. This banter of theirs. Perhaps it does more than it purports to. Perhaps it evades the deeper issues somehow. Jen thinks sometimes that Kelly is so busy laughing that he never does anything else, like show how he feels. What's the bedrock underneath the banter? Their family has always been so full of charm, exactly what she wanted after her repressed upbringing. But isn't humour a different kind of repression? Lights appear in the rearview mirror, a halo of blue. Kelly's eyes dart to them and become illuminated, his navy gaze turning aquamarine just for 1 second. That's right, something is coming back to Jen. What is it? Is there an accident or... No. No, they get pulled over. That's right. Nothing comes of it. She knows that. That's why it had faded into the past so easily. She remembers being so panicked at the time. And now, look, it's just like Andy said. She can observe it. Her gaze moves to the speedometer, but Kelly's doing 30 up the slip road. He never speeds, never pays tax, never travels, never goes to parties, never gets to know anyone, sits quietly at dinner parties. It's the popo, Todd says, laughing in the back seat, still so innocent. Jen's back feels uncomfortable, like there's a hostile gaze on it. She turns to look at Todd, who gets arrested in 4.5 years' time for murder and doesn't seem to care, has jaded, old, unfocused eyes as they handcuff him. She reaches to squeeze his knee, which fits in her palm perfectly. The police turn their lights off, then flick them on again. Jen looks in the mirror. An officer in the driver's seat, in a black vest, is pointing very obviously to the left. "Pull over, I guess," she says to Kelly. The police start indicating. Blue lights meet orange. "Yep, they want us," Kelly says. But his voice, Jen's gaze goes to his. Jaw set, eyes on the mirror, his hand withdrawn from her knee, his tone, furious. Not about a speeding ticket or whatever, but about something else, something bigger. She never would have noticed it the first time. She was feeling anxious too, but now that she is calm, she notices. That anger that sometimes seems to simmer beneath the surface of her husband's caustic wit. Kelly wrenches the wheel at the top of the slip road. He takes a left to the services and pulls over at the verge. Two wheels on, two wheels off, at an angle, which seems somehow hostile, like a teenager who won't cooperate. A male officer appears at the driver's side. He's got a completely round head, bald, shining under the bright lights of the service station slip road. There's something satisfying about the symmetry of it, like a football. He has a chain around his neck, a big thick one, like a fighting dog would wear. "All right," he says when Kelly winds the window down. Spring air drifts in. "Just doing some random breathalysing on the bank holiday. Happy to participate?" He has an expectant smile on his face, but it isn't a question. Kelly's eyes go to the dashboard, the front windscreen, and then to the policeman. Jen watches every single movement he makes. "Sure," he says, unfolding himself from the car. As he does so, Jen watches him remove his wallet from the back pocket of his jeans and drop it, a completely fluid movement. It falls and skitters onto the seat like a beetle, unnoticed in the darkness of the car, except to her. "You gonna bag me then?" Kelly says, Jen thinks impatiently. The policeman obliges, and Kelly blows into the breathalyzer, standing there by the side of the road as the cars whip by, his hands on his hips. He doesn't ever drink when he's driving, not even a pint. This is why Jen didn't worry. This is why Jen didn't remember. But look, she's here. There must be a reason why, once again, everything points to her husband. "Why would they breathalyze people randomly?" Todd asks. "Oh, because some idiots like to drink on bank holidays and then drive." Kelly gets back into the car and winds the window up. He must be sitting on the wallet. It can't be comfortable, but his face gives nothing away, absolutely nothing. He flashes Jen a quick, easy look. "Jesus, does he know this isn't LAPD?" he says. "Wasn't it a bit scary to be pulled over?" she asks. I'd always be terrified I'd done something wrong. Not at all, Kelly says mildly. Jen bites her lip. There, in the front seat, a spectator on her own marriage. When was the last time Kelly did tell her something had bothered him? Has he ever? She goes hot suddenly in the car. What keeps this man awake at night? What makes him mad? What will he regret on his deathbed? She suddenly finds in the passenger seat next to the man she has pledged to love forever that she can't answer a single one of these questions. Jen is sitting in pajamas, cross-legged, on the velvet sofa. An old lamp is lit, one they get rid of in a few years. Tonight, Jen is glad to be back here, in the past, in the comfortable surroundings she didn't quite know she had missed. Kelly's wallet is in her hands. It's brown leather, worn at the edges like a dog-eared novel. He has their joint account card. That's it, no credit cards, no debit cards of his own. He has 3 pound coins, his locker token for the gym, and his driving license. Jen stares at them, spread across her lap. They're totally normal. What would she expect to find? What illegal item could anybody possibly keep in their wallet anyway? She squints down at the ID. The hologram. She isn't sure. She vaults off the sofa to get her own driving license, setting them down side by side. Are the holograms the same? She holds them up to the light. No, they're not exactly the same. No, his is flatter somehow. She googles counterfeited driving licenses on her phone. The best way to tell, an article says, is to look at the hologram. It cannot be successfully replicated. Accompanying it are two photographs, one of a real driving license and one of a fake. The fake hologram looks exactly like the one on Kelly's. She can't deal with this. Finding and finding and finding things which she wishes she could forget. She turns the lamp out, just sitting there in the darkness of the living room, on the comfort of their old sofa, her husband's forged identity held in her hands.